WBO of Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Support for KABU comes from our members and from Nutrition Inside, presenting the Nutrition Inside Benefit Show, Saturday, August 16th from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at Ethos Music Center. The event will feature local music and refreshments and supports food justice for incarcerated individuals. More info at nutritioninside.org.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Good evening, you're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma Lugo and I'm a co-host. And today we're here with Mark Wilson from the Oregon Justice Resource Center and Gallo Van from 4D Recovery. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming here to the KABU Studios. We're here today to talk about kind of how the ODOC has dropped the ball on recovery services and, you know, the need for more services for people before they get out. So let's start, first of all, by having you gentlemen introduce yourselves to us and tell us about where you work and what you do, and then we'll get into this topic. Why don't we start with you, Mark?
Okay. My name is Mark Wilson. I am formerly incarcerated. I've just now been out about 6 months after serving 37 and a half years, going in when I was 18 years old. Today I work as a paralegal and policy associate at the Oregon Justice Resource Center here in Portland, Oregon. We are a nonprofit law firm that provides services to communities that are underrepresented, that are impacted by our criminal justice system, or criminal legal system, I should say. You know, our mission is to frustrate and dismantle mass incarceration. We have about 55 employees, and about 30% of them are formerly incarcerated.
Great. Thank you so much. OJRC is great. Yeah, we love them. Great. And Gallo, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Absolutely. I am formerly incarcerated as well. That's actually where I met and began working with Mark. I served 10 years and 3 months for causing a drunk driving collision. I received manslaughter one, mandatory minimum sentence, reckless driving, reckless endangerment, and felony DUI. During my time in the Oregon Department of Corrections, I walked into a slightly different reality than what Mark will talk about, because it was well after the advent of the war on drugs, tough on crime, and mandatory minimum sentencing laws. I now, luckily, work at 4D Recovery, and 4D works to support deflection efforts to get people into treatment and peer recovery services instead of into the criminal legal system, and also provides clean and sober activities through our community centers for folks who are attempting to work on their recovery to be able to go to safe spaces and get to know folks in a clean and sober way. And then also where I work are in clinical treatment services.
Great. Thanks so much. Yeah. So, Mark, we're talking today about, you know, the need for more recovery services and for more rehabilitation services in ODOC, you know, throughout the length of someone's sentence. And you've had, you know, you kind of have seen the world from both sides because you were in a long time ago when there were a lot of services and then you saw how services kind of dried up. So yes. Could you talk about that?
Yes. So let me start, I guess, with the services that don't exist today. And what I'll tell you about that is that about 80% of our prison population has drug and alcohol problems, but about 4% are able to get treatment before they are released from incarceration. And that is a policy choice by our lawmakers, by our governor, by our prison officials. It's not required because that's not the way it used to be. When I entered the system in the 1980s, we hadn't gotten tough on crime yet. And still embraced rehabilitation in Oregon. And so when I entered the prison system, it was more like what I would have imagined a college would be than a prison. You know, I mean, there were college programs, there were treatment programs of every kind. You know, and so someone would come into a prison with issues that they didn't deal with in the community, then caused them to act out in ways that brought them to prison. They were able to get those addressed in while incarcerated, and it was a priority to get them addressed. When I entered the system, I had a severe methamphetamine addiction, and I was fortunate to get 42 months of drug and alcohol treatment for that addiction, and I needed every second of that treatment to overcome my addiction. And if without that treatment, I probably wouldn't be here today. And unfortunately, when we got tough on crime, all of those programs were eliminated no later than 95. A lot of them were gone by 1992. And since then, we've only warehoused prisoners. And to illustrate that point, my release counselor is a staff member who had been with the Department of Corrections for over 20 years. And when I walked into his office, the first words out of his mouth were, "How in the hell did you get 42 months of drug and alcohol treatment?" He'd never seen it in the entire time he'd been in the system. And unfortunately, most of the staff working within the Department of Corrections now have worked their entire careers during the tough on crime era, where they've never seen programming be available to prisoners. So.
Wow. Gosh, that's so almost 30 years. I mean, more than a generation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 30 years, that's long enough for somebody to really do an entire term of service, I mean, as an employee and retire and not have any awareness of what it was like when there were rehabilitative services that actually had a meaningful impact.
And the problem with that is that, you know, I mean, I saw myself and these young and not so young addicted prisoners coming into our prison system. And now, you know, they were just warehoused in a cage until their sentence expired and then released. And in the best case, they didn't use while they were incarcerated. But they did nothing to help that addiction while they were incarcerated. And then most of those people would then quickly return to that addiction after incarceration. And, you know, that is why we see the drug and alcohol problem in our streets, the homeless problem in our streets. And that's kind of, when I say it's a policy decision, I'm really critical of Governor Kotek at this point, because she continues to claim that addiction is one of her three priorities since she's taken office, but has done nothing to provide addiction services to the 80% that are incarcerated who have these issues, when that is the intervention point that could prevent some of these people from returning to drugs and alcohol when they return to the community.
Wow. So, Gillo, what do you think about this? I mean, you saw it from a different perspective, but now you work as, you know, you work in drug and alcohol counseling, and you work in recovery services. So, I mean, you both see how there maybe weren't the services available that needed to be available, like while you were on the inside. Now that you're on the outside and you're doing this kind of recovery work on the outside, what needs to happen on the inside to make things better?
Well, I always really enjoyed talking to Mark because of the sense of perspective and time that he's able to provide, doing so much time in the Oregon Department of Corrections, unfortunate as he is that he had to be there that long. So when I hear about all of the services available at the beginning of his sentence, it's something that I can't even really imagine, because I walked into a very different condition in 2015 when I entered the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am a person who struggles with addiction to alcohol and opioids. And when I got into prison, I just remember reaching this point that I was out of answers and that I couldn't come up with the solutions that were going to help me. And that I was looking for anything to provide me with guidance. I was finally ready to ask for help, which was a big part of the antisocial cognitions that I had. And there was nothing there to meet me. I remember I couldn't even get on into an AA meeting for maybe like 5 months, 5 or 6 months after I arrived at Snake River Correctional Institution. There were spots open, but just not an administrator who was willing to cycle people who weren't participating anymore off of the list and allow me to have a chance. So I just had to send inmate communications for months in order to finally get on, because I think I bugged him enough. So Mark refers to about 80% of the people who are in the system as needing alcohol and drug recovery services, and only 4% receiving them. Criminological research indicates that the top 6 criminogenic factors in individuals contributing to their criminal behaviors are antisocial characteristics, antisocial cognitions, low impulse control, dysfunctional family, criminal peers, and substance use. I think there are just over 12,000 people who are in the Oregon Department of Corrections right now. For most of the time that I was inside, it was higher than that, around 15,000. And if we have people who have these antisocial behaviors, like addictions or substance use disorder, and we have a system that's criminalizing this medical condition, they're all going to get focused in one place. And some of the most severe and co-occurring addictions, people who have polysubstance addiction, addiction to more than one substance at a time. And in addition to that, most of the folks that are going in, especially into the Oregon Department of Corrections, have co-occurring mental health disorders. These are folks whose antisocial behaviors and treatable, highly treatable conditions are focused in one place. And it would make sense that instead of 4% of the people being screened as needing these services, it would make more sense that 100% of these people would receive the right of patients who have a medical disease to receive treatment, because it affects their activities of daily living, and this is life or death as a disease, as a condition. And it's a really difficult for people to grasp the disease concept, but if you do just some quick searches on YouTube, you'll be able to find out how the pleasure reward system of the body is hijacked. It's all very interesting. And I would just really like to see the expansion of these services.
Mark and Gallo, let me ask you both a question, just a really basic question I think a lot of people might ask themselves when they're hearing this, maybe if they're not familiar with the world of advocacy for people who have been formerly incarcerated. A lot of people might think, well, I mean, isn't the point of going to prison to punish you and to teach you that you're not supposed to do that? So, like, if you go in to some place where your freedom is taken away, and isn't that punishment enough to make you think, oh, I shouldn't do this again? I mean, what about that?
I certainly agree, but there's that is a sentiment that people have. Yes. There's a common saying.
And by the way, that's not anything that I think at all. I'm just asking you to think about how somebody might be hearing you.
Yeah, definitely. There's a saying in the recovery community that the opposite of addiction is connection. And if you imagine prisons, this is a place where people are the most disconnected from society that they can possibly be. It's actually very expensive to be incarcerated. Any communication to the outside or any type of literature or information coming in comes at a cost, paying for envelopes, paper, phone calls. If you use a tablet messaging service, you have to pay for every message, any subscription services, things like that. So, it's a very disconnected place. And inside the Oregon Department of Corrections, if you are caught with any drugs or alcohol or you take a UA, a urine test for drugs or alcohol, and you receive any positive results, you're further disconnected from the things that might keep you accountable or keep you moving in the right direction. You'll lose a job if you have a good job. You'll lose your housing and get moved into segregation or a solitary. You will lose visits, direct in-person visits with your family members who are perhaps the only support network who would hold you accountable in this place. There's no messaging inside the Oregon Department of Corrections about being a better person or working and identifying issues that have caused you hardship in your past. And I think that the general public believes that people who are in prison are being told and being helped to be better people, but you're just sitting there.
It sounds like this, earlier in the conversation, Mark, you were talking about changes that happened as early as 1992. I mean, for those of us who are old enough to remember, I mean, we remember what happened with the Clinton administration and the kind of propaganda that the Clinton administration put out as part of like having 100,000 new police officers on the streets and being tough on crime. I mean, this is a Democrat who got swept into office, basically using the same kind of language that the Reagan and Bush administrations had used before them in order to, you know, make their way into office. And they did create these huge changes in, you know, corrections all around the country, which stripped services mm-hmm. from people who had access to services. What happened? What is the result of this tough on crime denial of services?
Sure.
And what do we need to do to turn things around?
Yeah, and I'd like to, you know, piggyback off what Galo said there for a minute as well. People do subscribe to that some of that tough on crime thinking at this point, where they think prisoners do not deserve programs or rehabilitation. The question is, do you deserve the prisoners to receive those programs? Because, you know, 90%+ of our prisoners are returning to the community. Do you want them returning to the community as broken or more broken by their experience than as they went when they went in? Or do you want them to become healed, good neighbors, right? And so the thinking that, well, you don't deserve these programs is just backwards thinking. And so that is kind of what happened when, and you're right, it was the Clinton administration that is probably the number one driver of mass incarceration. They killed prisoner Pell grants. They created truth in sentencing incentive grants, where the states would receive federal money if they built or expanded prisons and made prisoners serve at least 80% of their time in prison. And so states quickly signed up to make you do mandatory Measure 11 type sentences. And made prisons as harsh as possible. In my experience, most people in prison are what I would call, it's probably wrong to call people broken, you know, but you know, it's the dichotomy. People say, well, people in prison are evil. And it's like, I've never met an evil person. Basically, the people I saw were broken people, including myself, right? And, you know, there's a saying, you know, hurt people hurt people. And, you know, to me, it rings really true, because people end up in prison because they weren't able to address the issues themselves in their lives. And there were a lot of different breakdown points before they got to incarceration. And so if they could fix those problems themselves without programs, then we wouldn't be having these conversations. And so right now what we do is we lock them up and we put them in a cage and we don't give them the help. Well, those people don't have, like the mentally right. ill people, they don't have the ability to fix their mental illness. If you don't give people the treatment for drugs and alcohol, you don't have the ability to do that. And then, you know, despite what we're doing inside incarceration, the problem also includes what we do when we let them out of prison. We don't give them the reentry services they need. I mean, if you're not going to give them drug and alcohol treatment in the community or in the prison, at least give it to them in the community. And they don't have any interest in doing any of that. When I was released, I went to R&D, it's receiving a discharge. Got dressed out to go out of prison, and there were two other guys with me, and the sergeant there was all happy. He says, "Hey guys, come on over here." And we went over to this cart, and on that cart were three backpacks. He says, "Hey, we got this backpack we're going to give you today. Go ahead and pick one and take it home with you." Well, that night I opened the backpack, and inside the backpack was a blanket and a rain tarp. And that's what these people were patting themselves on the back for giving prisoners as they walked out the door.
Sometimes now they just get a garbage bag instead of a backpack. Yeah. Let's talk about what kind of services people need in the last few minutes of the show. What kind of services do people need while they're inside, like especially during the term of their service rather than at the end, to, you know, really make a difference in life once they get out?
Certainly. I think it helps to have a historical context. The first, in America, the first ways that we dealt with observable addictions were sending people to their doctors. And then we saw the beginnings of treatment. And treatment is a very focused amount of time that is generally a short amount of time, usually 30 days, can go up to about a year and a half, but it's more rare to see these younger or longer terms of treatment care. And as a drug and alcohol counselor, I'm given two tools to evaluate folks and try to determine what they need. The first is doing a diagnosis for substance use disorder, which is just identifying the severity of substance use disorder for a specific substance for an individual. And then the second thing is using an American Society of Addiction Medicine assessment tool, which helps me to know what the level of care is that somebody needs, whether it's just somebody getting going to an informational session for alcohol and drug education, or if they have to go to maybe level one treatment and meet with a counselor an hour a week, or a higher level where maybe they're spending several hours, several times a week in a treatment setting, doing classes and having discussions about their issues with substances, or if somebody has to go to residential. So
that's work that you do on the outside. And so part of what you're saying is that that's also what needs to happen on the inside.
Yeah, but also not just treatment. We're moving into this new paradigm, out of medical into treatment, and then out of treatment into this recovery-oriented systems of care model, where we take treatment ideas out of the darkness. And it is so important to have places that are safe, where there is anonymity. But at a certain point, in order for a person to grow, part of that very often is claiming their recovery and living it in their outside lives, in the community, in their personal lives, and applying everything that they've learned during that time in the community. And so it really is not only treatment, but it's having clean and sober and recovery-oriented activities all the time. And as a drug and alcohol counselor, what I am empowered to do is only to prescribe somebody to a certain amount of time in a treatment setting, or a recovery setting, rather. And so what we would hope is to return to a paradigm kind of like Mark entered into, where you could get 42 months of treatment instead of what we have today, where 4% of people who are assessed as needing treatment, and that does not by any means catch everybody who needs it. The DOC only catches people through screening tools and finds anywhere from like 67 to 71% of people on any given day are assessed as needing treatment. But it is behavioral health services administrators themselves who estimate the 80 to 85% rate that Mark is talking about. So it's not even caught by the numbers, by the screening tools that the DOC has. So we know it's a bigger problem than what is reported.
So, sorry to interrupt. So Mark, how are we going to pay for this? That's something that I think a lot of voters would want to know. Like, how are we paying? I mean, even if people are really sympathetic and they want there to be more rehabilitative services.
Sure.
I mean, how is this going to be paid for?
Well, So yeah, and let me again piggyback off of GLOW and say that, you know, to answer your earlier question about what needs to be in the system now, and that, in my view, that is treatment for 100% of the people who have the issue, right? And so to answer your question about how do we pay for that, this is an issue where the science and our lawmakers have said that substance abuse addiction is a medical condition. Okay, prison officials are required to treat medical conditions. They are not allowed to deny medical care for a treatable medical condition, and they're not allowed to do that based on expense or lack of services. They have to provide those services. And so, you know, what is it, $8,000 or something like that? The Secretary of State audit said it was like $8,000 a year to put one person through 6 months of treatment. So one of the things that we need to be looking at is reducing our addiction to incarceration, reducing our prison population. Though it costs $141 a day or $55,000 a year, according to DOC on their website, to incarcerate one prisoner, where it costs $13 a day to supervise them in the community. And that's the high end. The average is, you know, like $7 a day to supervise them in the community. So $8,000 plus $13 a day, which is like $4,000 a year. So $12,000 total to provide drug treatment and supervision in the community versus $55,000 of incarceration costs for something that can be treated outside. And so it can be done by doing that, but even if they choose not to do that, they have to pay to do that. And litigation is likely going to be the way that that is forced, because they don't seem to have the will to do it on their own.
Yeah. Great. Well, there's so much to talk about, but we're already out of time, if you can believe it. I mean, this goes so fast. Mark, just one more time, tell us again about your work at OJRC, and then we'll get to you, GLOW.
So I work at OJRC.
And people want to contact you.
Yeah, I work at OJRC as a paralegal and policy associate, and you can contact OJRC on the web at OJRC.org. You know, you can reach me there. You can, you know, I mean, you can look at our various projects. We've got a lot of different reports on the website of things that we publish, and you can see our work there. And, you know, I mean, any support that people can give to our work, it would be greatly appreciated as well.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, GLOW. If people would like to find out about you or your organization, how can they learn more about that?
Yeah, you can find 4D Recovery online.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us today on Prison Pipeline. We've been talking with Mark Wilson and GLOW Van. Thanks so much for joining us, and I will hopefully you can join us again soon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations